The Hand of Carlos, Charles McCary. The terrorist's Arabic was poor and his Farsi was non-existent, but he had a quick ear for hidden meanings. That was why he was still alive. That was why he was alone with this mad old man, speaking French, waiting to hear the name of his target. He inclined his head and waited for the holy man to speak again. They were seated on the floor of a plain, small room in a simple house in the holy city of Qum. The holy man, squatting on the coarse wool blanket that was his bed by night and his throne by day, smelled of dust. Beside him lay the bowl from which he had eaten his lunch of rice and yogurt. The terrorist, whose taste ran to steak au poivre, had been unable to eat the food. Now, smelling it on the old man's sour breath, he wished he had. The holy man was the most successful revolutionary in the world. The richest and most ancient kingdom in the Near East lay at his feet. He imagined that he had conquered Iran by the power of his faith and the strength of his voice. But the terrorist knew that he had had help. The military youth who were the cutting edge of the holy man's revolution had been trained and armed in the camps of the Palestinian terror front. The terrorist himself had learned to use his workmanlike Soviet weapons, the 9mm Makarov pistol, the Scorpion machine pistol, the AK-47 assault rifle, in those camps. In the name of the Palestinian struggle, which was the personal cause of every progressive revolutionary in the world, the terrorist had shot an old Jew in London. He had bombed innocent people in Paris, kidnapped the head of the Iranian secret police, killed two French counterintelligence men and a traitor. Shot an Arab by mistake. He was not even an Arab. He had spilled all that blood out of idealism. The holy man understood. It meant little to him. He was the spiritual leader of the Shia Muslims. To him, there was no blood except the blood spilled on the 19th of Ramadan, AH 40, 655 AD, when Ali, the son-in-law, cousin, and chosen heir of the Prophet Muhammad, was assassinated as he prayed in Mosque of Kufa. The Shia believed that Islam had been led ever since by usurpers, for none but a descendant of Ali and of Muhammad's daughter Fatima could be the true successor to the Prophet. The holy man wore the black turban of a descendant of Muhammad. He slept always on his right side, as Ali had commanded the imams to do. The terrorist was in the presence of the holy man because he was a famous assassin, but the Shia had given the world the very word assassin. From the ranks of this sect, 800 years ago, came the Order of Assassins, the Hashishin, takers of hashish, who set out systematically to murder the usurpers. The enemies of Ali's younger son, Hussein, had refused him water when they slew him in the desert. The Shia had never forgotten or forgiven this bitter act of cruelty. It was a rite of remembrance to Hussein and to the justice of the Shia cause that no pious Shia ever put any creature to death, not a sheep on a feast day, not a chicken bought in the bazaar, not the most hated human enemy, without first offering it a drink of water. The holy man at last opened his dry lips. The terrorist leaned closer.
"The Shah," said the holy man, "must be offered a cup of water."
The terrorist handed him a slip of paper on which a dollar sign followed by six digits had been written. The holy man nodded, wearily, in agreement.
"Shamat," the terrorist said. It was the only Persian he knew. It meant, "The king is dead."
For this operation, the terrorist took the name Paco, and he traveled out of Tehran like any ordinary person in a first-class airline seat. In his attaché case, in addition to the bottle of gasoline that he could sprinkle over a stewardess in an emergency, he carried an excellent Mexican passport forged by East German experts working with the Libyan intelligence service. Paco was enjoying himself thoroughly. The stewardesses had that wonderful silken skin that only German girls had, and those slender long legs that bourgeois German girls were so willing to spread for the revolution. He put his hand on the waist of one of the stewardesses and smiled at her and asked for another Martell brandy.
"Only Martell," he said. "No substitutes."
The stewardess smiled at him and he thought that he saw the beginning of something in her eyes. Even before his plastic surgery, he had always had all the girls he wanted. Now he had even more. The East German doctors had given him a better face, thinning the lips that once had looked like blue slugs,
taking the flab out of the cheeks and the chin. Paco turned back to the American professor, who was his seatmate. It pleased Paco, who loved to talk and loved to lie, to tell this man that he, Paco, was an important figure in the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine.
"The PFLP is the terrorist arm of the PLO, isn't it?"
the American asked. There was respect in his voice. Not for a moment did he doubt that Paco, who spoke English with a heavy Latinate accent and drank enough cognac to kill a horse, was an Arab and a devout Muslim.
"You disapprove of terror?" Paco asked.
The professor lifted a soft bourgeois hand. Who could imagine a gun or a woman's breast in such a hand? To protest.
"I sympathize," he said, "but..."
"There can be no buts," said Paco, scowling, making this sympathizer squirm. "Did you sympathize before the terror started? We were invisible to you. We are doctors of philosophy. George Habash, our chief terrorist, is a children's doctor. But you forced us to kill before you would see our suffering, before you would sympathize. That shows how sick you and your capitalist society are."
The American professor gave him a look filled with shame.
"I hate it as much as you do," he said. "More, because all the heroes are on your side."
Paco felt a rush of pleasure. How these pretenders, these toy store revolutionaries, loved to be insulted, whipped, blamed. They hated their country, their parents, their species, because they hated themselves. They were doomed. The stewardess came back with the Martell brandy, a whole bottle, and Paco put a forefinger on the back of her hand as she poured, pressing down so that she had to fill the glass to the rim. If she knew who he really was, he could have her in the lavatory. Watching her legs as she walked away, he was tempted to follow and tell her. Showing them a gun made them hot. He knew that from experience.
"It is not possible," said the sweating major. "It is not possible to go out to the camps without the personal permission of Colonel Gaddafi."
Paco stared through his sunglasses at the sweating German. How was it that a country which produced such perfect women as the stewardesses on the Lufthansa flight could also produce such pigs for men? The major was past his youth. The desert sun had reddened his skin, and there was a great wrinkle of fat on the back of his thick neck. Also, like all the East Germans who sat in every office of Libyan intelligence, he was a racist filled with contempt for Arabs. Paco himself was exasperated by Arabs. They were undependable, inefficient, maddening in their bloody-mindedness. But they were, to Paco, the symbol of the cause. To this German, they were a subject race, beaky and circumcised.
"Gaddafi refuses me nothing," Paco said.
"That's your story,"
the German major said, but he lifted the telephone and ordered the transport that Paco had requested. For a rarity, it was quite true what Paco had said. Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, dictator of Libya, financier and keeper of the weapons warehouse of international terrorism, refused this peacock of a Latin American nothing. It was even said, and the major believed it, that Gaddafi had given Paco $10 million in payment for kidnapping the oil minister of Saudi Arabia and the head of SAVAK, the Shah's secret police. It was also said that the Saudis and the Shah had put $50 million in ransom into Paco's Swiss bank account. Anyway, he had let his prisoners go without harming a hair on their heads. The major didn't like him. He didn't care if the KGB had recruited and trained him. He didn't care about his exploits. He was a romantic, a weakling who liked women and food and liquor, and above all, money. Too much. Paco was a show-off. If he couldn't be bought, he could be outwitted. Paco was smoking a stinking gulwaz. He chain-smoked the things. The Bedouin band moved across the desert floor, black figures trudging along beside a file of camels and a horse or two. A few miles ahead of the main body, a Land Rover bucked through the rough country, stirring up a plume of dust that could be seen for miles. Through the perspex window of the small plane, Paco could see the weapons in the hands of the three men who rode with the headman in the Land Rover. He focused the plane's binoculars on the vehicle. Two of the men were equipped with Czech VZ-58s, a version of the AK-47 that had a nasty tendency to climb when fired on full automatic. The other carried a Dragunov sniper's rifle, a heavy, clumsy Soviet weapon that could put a heavy slug through a vest button at 900 meters. These desert tramps were coming up in the world. On the horizon, an hour's drive for the Land Rover and 4 hours' march for the camels, Paco could see the Bedouin's objective, a well among the scrub. He had the Palestinian pilot make a long circle to the south, then come in low, below the crest of the hills and out of sight of the Bedouins, and land. "Fly out low, circle, and pass over the column again," Paco said. "Don't let them know you've landed." The plane, an American Bonanza, Paco didn't trust Russian aircraft engines over the desert, churned away, creating a stinging sandstorm. Paco found a hiding place on a knoll overlooking the campground and settled down in the shade of a rubbery, anemic bush that probably had roots 50 meters deep. If you cut it down, it would reach into the soil and find moisture and grow again, like the revolution. In the distance, Paco could see the column of the dust raised by the Land Rover. He opened his pack and checked its contents. First, he checked the 2 9-millimeter Makarov pistols, oiled and loaded and stored in Ziploc plastic bags, another marvelous contribution to civilization by the Americans. He worked the bolt of his Scorpion, only 10.6 inches long with the butt folded, but capable of spewing 7.65 millimeter rounds at a rate of 14 rounds a second. 4 RGD-5 anti-personnel grenades, painted cheap Russian green, nestled like eggs at the bottom of the sack. They weighed only a little over 0.5 pound, about half as much as the far more powerful U.S. Army M-52 fragmentation grenades stolen from a U.S. base in West Germany by the Bader-Meinhof gang. Paco waited, watching the dust of the Land Rover. When he could hear its gearbox howling, he took off his sunglasses so that the mirrors would not flash in the sun and give away his position. It was dusk before Paco moved again. The crew of the Land Rover had searched the perimeter of the camp, studying the tracks of the light plane on the floor of the wadi. At last the camels came, the tents sprang up, and the cooking fires were lighted. Paco, crawling over the flinty ground, took up a position near the latrine, some 50 meters from the black tents. The leader had been haranguing his men. Now he slung his assault rifle across his back and headed for the latrine. Paco, who knew his habits, waited. The leader hiked up his robes, swirling the layers of cloth around his body, holding up the robes with both hands and both elbows. Straddling the ditch, he was absolutely helpless. Paco smiled at the man's buttocks, fish white, and fired all 8 rounds from the Makarov between his legs, the slugs, traveling at the tremendous velocity of 1,023 feet per second, zipped into the earth. Paco had known there was no chance of a ricochet with this weapon. The leader fell over sideways, more afraid of the filth in the ditch than of death, clawing for his slung weapon, swaddled and tripped by his robes. Paco put another clip into his Makarov, just in case, and began to laugh uproariously. The fallen man, tearing at his VZ-58, now looked up at Paco. Paco put on his mirror sunglasses.
"It's you," said the Bedouin leader. "You turd conceived by a jackal on a syphilitic whore rutting on a dung heap."
The other members of the band were running toward them, assault rifles and machine pistols at the ready. Paco pulled the leader to his feet.
"You'd better tell them who I am," said Paco.
The leader gave a hand signal and the advancing tribesmen halted. The leader introduced Paco, never mentioning the name by which the world knew him. He spoke first in Arabic, for he was a Palestinian from Jerusalem, and then in English, German, and French, for the tribesmen were men and women all in their early 20s who had come from the cities of Europe to learn how to do all the things that Paco already did so well. They knew perfectly well who their visitor was. Paco could see it in their eyes. Paco ate the Spartan dinner, almost as bad as the rice and yogurt he had been given in Qum, and kept an aloof silence. The young terrorist's apprentices watched his every move. It was hard to tell what the girls looked like under these robes, but he sat next to the one with the prettiest face. When she put down her plate, he tossed his dirty Makarov into her lap.
"Clean this," he said.
Of the dozen bands of terrorists disguised as Bedouins that were now training in the Libyan desert, Paco had chosen this one because he knew that his old friend would have trained its members well in the use of weapons and in the making of bombs, and trained them even better in the most indispensable weapon of all, blind obedience. Paco, speaking to them, a legend speaking in the desert with the firelight flickering in the mirrors of his sunglasses, did not tell them that.
"Some of you have been chosen for a historic job," Paco told them. "I am leading. I expect we will all die, but before we do, we will accomplish our objective. I need 2 Germans, 4 Italians, 2 Spanish speakers, 2 explosives experts from the IRA provost, 1 American. Amir will tell you which of you is chosen. That's all."
Later, lying beside the girl who had cleaned his pistol, Paco advised her, as a sign of his satisfaction with her, never to carry any pistol other than the Makarov.
"I shot a Jew in London with a Browning," he said, "and the bullet was stopped by his teeth. Not enough muzzle velocity. In Paris, a round from the Makarov went through a French DST man, through the floor, through a table in the room below, and then into the floorboards under the table. Or so the newspapers said."
Paco placed the cold gun on the girl's flat stomach. She put her hand over the gun. That was all the invitation he needed. While he had her, she shuddered and said wonderful things in Spanish.
"I thought you were the prize American," he said to her afterward. "How do you speak such learned Spanish?"
The girl explained. She had gone to Cuba to work with the Venceremos brigades, cutting sugarcane for Castro. The DGI, the Cuban Intelligence Service, had picked her up. She'd been trained in one of the camps outside Havana before she was chosen for Libya.
"What's your name?"
"Layal."
"Not your game name. Your name."
"My name is Rosemary Kadawaki."
"Rosemary?"
"I was born in Los Angeles. Are you really who the others say you are? They said you were dead, that you had disappeared, that you had left the movement."
"They say what they like. I act," said Paco.
Paco loved to talk. He had always loved to talk. He lifted the girl's hair, it was damp with sweat, and whispered into her ear.
"Shamat," he whispered. "Do you know what that means?"
The girl looked up at him with adoring eyes. He had only been in bed with her for an hour, less, and she was willing to die for him. Paco knew from experience that this was so. The Israeli, whose work name was Eleazar, closed the file and looked across the desk at his control.
"Carlos is going to kill the Shah?" he said.
"Someone who is perhaps Carlos has been hired to kill the Shah," said the control. "There is a report that the holy man personally gave him the contract."
"Do we have a description of this Carlos?"
"He's using the name Paco. The story is that his appearance has been altered by plastic surgery. He has all of Carlos's behavior patterns. Ego, lust, recklessness, loquacity, contempt for women and the opposition."
"Fingerprints? Did they blood type him before he entered Libya?"
Each terrorist who entered Libya for training gave up a smear of blood. Other smears were taken at every subsequent meeting and the DNA was compared. It was an ingenious, foolproof method of identification, the East German touch.
"What good are fingerprints?" asked the control. "The fingerprints Carlos left in Paris and the fingerprints he left on the plane after the OPEC kidnapping were not the same."
"Do you think he was bought on that plane?"
asked Eleazar.
"Did the Saudis and the Shah buy him with $50 million in a Swiss bank account?"
"Anything is possible. Hans Joachim Klein, the German terrorist who was wounded with Carlos in Vienna, swears that he was bought."
"So," said Eleazar, "maybe it's Carlos and maybe it isn't, but they are going to kill the Shah."
"They are going to try. Do you think we should let fools murder a friend of Israel?"
"What about the Americans?"
A droplet of contemptuous silence formed in the stale air of the windowless room.
"The Americans," said the control. "Impotent."
Then he said,
"Eleazar, I want you to get your team together again."
Eleazar's Wrath of God team, Israelis trained as commandos, had reached into the rat holes of Europe, Germany, Scandinavia, even Poland, to liquidate in a cold fury of revenge the Palestinians who had murdered the Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics, and all who had helped them. Eleazar picked up his medical bag.
"I'll contact the team,"
he said. With Paco at his side, Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi watched impassively as Amir's team carried out an exercise. They handled all the weapons of the Soviet arsenal up to the RPG-7 portable rocket launcher and the shoulder-fired SAM-7 Strela anti-aircraft missile with consummate skill. Paco did not like these heavy weapons. He had tried to rocket an Israeli airliner at Orly Airport in Paris and later had attempted to bring down a passenger jet with the Strela. Neither operation had gone right. These clumsy battlefield devices were not for terrorists. They gave too much warning. Qaddafi wore his usual outfit, starched safari suit, British-style officer's cap, burnished buckled shoes without socks. He was always ready to dart barefoot into the mosque to pray. He carried a swagger stick. Revolution makes strange bedfellows, thought Paco. Here he was, an atheist whose millionaire father, a cafe communist from Venezuela, had named his three sons Vladimir, Ilyich, and Lenin after the first Soviet saint, standing on a dune with a fanatical Muslim who had gone to Sandhurst, watching a crowd of children from good bourgeois Christian homes shoot up the landscape with guns made in Russia and Czechoslovakia. Paco followed Qaddafi down the ranks of terrorists. The colonel asked each where he or she had come from.
"Red Brigades Milano,"
they replied. Or,
"Red Army Faction Hamburg."
Or,
"Euskadi to Askantusa, Bilbao."
Or,
"Provisional IRA, Belfast."
To Layal, standing at attention with her assault rifle across her chest, Qaddafi said in English,
"And you are from the heroic Japanese Red Army?"
"No, Brother Colonel," said Layal. "I was born in California. In 1942, because we were Japanese, my family was robbed of its little farm and put into a concentration camp by the two-faced U.S. liberal imperialists. I have come here to help build the people's prisons where the American oppressors will pay for their crimes against humanity."
"Good," said Qaddafi. "Very good."
Qaddafi led Paco to his helicopter. The interior, like every interior belonging to Qaddafi, was decorated in shades of Islamic green. Green bulkheads, green upholstery, green perspex. The brother colonel drank tea from a green glass. He had left the machine guns blue-black. Qaddafi was in the middle of one of his long philosophical soliloquies. Paco sipped his tea, sickly sweet and minted. He liked the sweetness but hated the tea itself. It was hard enough following Qaddafi's ravings when you hadn't drunk a liter of tea. With your bladder bursting, it was next to impossible.
"You can do this?" Qaddafi asked.
"Yes, the plan is good. We have the people. Now we have your blessing, Brother Colonel. So we have everything."
"One thing only I demand," said Qaddafi.
Merde, thought Paco.
"The Shah has one friend in the world, this swine Sadat,"
Qaddafi said.
"In the end, he must run to Sadat in Egypt. Kill him there. Kill him before Sadat's eyes. Humiliate Sadat. Let him see how long my arm is, that it can reach into his very house and kill a king."
"At your orders, Brother Colonel," said Paco, and again he thought, "Merde. How am I going to get around this piece of madness?"
After fleeing from Iran on January 16, 1979, the Shah had gone to Egypt, then to Morocco, then to the Bahamas. Now word came to Paco that the Shah had rented a villa in the Mexican city of Cuernavaca, Mexico. The word came at night. It was June, and cold in the desert. Layal woke and listened in her silent way as Paco talked to the courier. He and the courier, an officer of the Cuban Directorate General of Intelligence, spoke in Spanish. It did not matter if she understood, here in the middle of nowhere.
"It's a tough target," said the Cuban. "We have a man inside the Shah's household, a survivor of the Communist League 23rd of September movement."
"Training?"
"He took our course in Havana. Then the GRU picked him up and shipped him to Dopov."
trained in Czechoslovakia by Soviet military intelligence and smart enough to survive the brutal Mexican search for the Communist League 23rd of September after it had massacred 40 Mexican policemen, kidnapped the daughter of the Belgian ambassador, and killed the son of the Mexican ambassador to the United States. A light came into Paco's eyes. He could use such a man.
No, said the Cuban, who had been reading Paco's eyes since Paris days. He's our last operative in Mexico who isn't scared shitless. You can't have him.
The Cuban told Paco about La Villa, the Shah's rented house in Cuernavaca. It was located at 100 Del Rio Street, on a steep hill near the river, screened by trees.
No chance of using rockets, of course, because of the trees, said the Cuban. There is a watchtower, ram-proof steel gates, the usual electronic stuff, infrared intruder detectors, tumbler alarms to pick up footsteps.
How many guards?
20 Americans, 34 Mexicans, 6 Iranians. Very well armed, very well paid. Oil company thugs.
You're telling me nothing cheerful. The Cuban grinned.
I saved the best for last. There is a tunnel, dug just before the Shah arrived, that leads from La Villa to another house.
Good, we can mine it.
That's not all. The Shah's men buy books about Trotsky at the local bookstores. He's fascinated with the details of how Stalin had Trotsky killed in Mexico. Second, a green station wagon brings in supplies twice a week and is not challenged at the gates. Third, the Shah has been talking about going out to dinner.
Going out to dinner?
To show he's got balls. He hears that Las Manitas is a good restaurant. Peacocks stroll in the grounds. He'll like that. The peacock throne.
Paco was in command now. He had separated the team into national groups, forbidding them to associate with each other or to speak each other's languages. The kids, thirsty for their chance to be a symbol of the revolution like Paco, gladly put up with this pointless bullying. He routed out the two Germans. Klaus, Paco had stripped the band, except for Layal, of their Arab game names, was a typical Bader-Meinhof type. Sullen, fanatical, intellectual, the son of a man who manufactured cars that he sold to Americans for $50,000 apiece, dressed his wife in sable and his teenage mistresses in Wehrmacht uniforms, black lace underneath, and was now as good a Democrat as he had once been a Nazi. Which was to say, in both cases, not awfully good, because money was what he was interested in, and there was very little money in ideals unless, like Paco, you provided certain unique services idealists could not do without. His son Klaus wanted to believe in something. He wanted to live like a soldier, sleeping rough and eating frugally. He wanted to die for a cause. His friend Bernhild was just as sullen, but simpler. She just wanted to kill. Anyone would do. Gabriel Kroscher-Tiedemann, Paco's teammate in Vienna, had been like that.
Are you a policeman?
She had asked an old man during their raid on OPEC headquarters.
Yes,
the old man replied. She shot him in the back of the neck and sent him down an elevator. Later, she shot another security guard and wanted to shoot more. In Paco's experience, Germans were useful people, so operatic in their love of themselves and in their love of death. They'd kill themselves if there was no one else around to murder. Klaus and Bernhild, trying not to shiver in the frigid desert air, awaited their orders. Paco, as he spoke to them, faced the dawn, and they saw the big yellow Saharan sun come up in his sunglasses.
I have a very important job for you, Paco said. Everything, I mean everything, depends on your success.
We will die for the revolution, said Klaus.
Probably, but first you will help others to do so, said Paco.
2 weeks later, a man and a woman posing as German tourists were arrested in Cuernavaca. They had been observed loitering near La Villa. When the Mexican police followed them home, they found grenades and automatic weapons. There were rumors that the Germans had in their possession a list of prominent Mexican citizens who were going to be assassinated if the Shah was not thrown out of the country. It was said that under questioning by Mexico Federal Security, the Germans had told everything about a plot to murder the Shah. No one asked the Germans, because they disappeared. Miguel Nazar Haro, director of Mexico Federal Security, would not confirm that the Germans had ever existed.
We do not deal lightly with terrorists in Mexico, said Nazar. That is why we have none.
He added that the Shah would always be safe in Mexico and that his agency was on the lookout for German and Japanese terrorists especially. He smiled a confident smile. When the green station wagon came through the gates of La Villa, after the Germans had disappeared, it carried among the groceries a copy of a book about Trotsky. One of the security men picked it up.
I thought we had a copy of this one, he said.
The book exploded, taking off both his hands and most of his face. This was Paco's way of saying,
Time to move.